Ridiculous Romance is a production of iHeartRadio.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Cool.
Ooh.
And
we have to put a quarter in a jar every time we say so, yeah.
Our so, yeah jar.
So, yeah.
So, yeah.
So,
well, now we've made 75 cents.
Yeah. Here's
There's a dollar.
The episode.
I'm Diana.
And I'm Eli.
This podcast is going to save our marriage because we're going to get to a point where we're like, ugh, done with you, but still want to do the show.
Yeah, but I feel like the podcast is going to be what pushes us to I'm done with you.
Oh, shit.
So it will both be the destruction and salvation of this ridiculous relationship.
Huh. It's like the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man.
Sorry?
In Ghostbusters, he
right.
was both the destruction and the salvation
oh, yeah, sure. yeah.
of New York City.
I needed some clarity in salvation, that side of it, because I saw the destruction. That was very clear. Salvation was interpretive, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was the salvation in that they picked a threat that they could handle. They handled it.
Wait, are you quoting destruction and salvation from the movie, or did you come up with that?
I came up with it.
Oh, I okay. Just, I thought it was like
destruction, salvation, and I thought of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man for some reason.
That's very strange.
Well,
I thought that
I'm very strange.
No, definitely. I love it. I just thought that when you said, because you know the movie really well, Zool said, you know, this shall be our destruction and salvation. Anyway, you get the idea.
I get it.
I thought it was a reference, but it's not. It's just
it
out
not.
Of your brain.
Just my brain.
Straight up. That's where
coming
you went.
Coming up with stuff. Making connections.
Well, in that case, it was interpretive.
Hmm. Great.
Cool.
Dope.
Great. Thanks for listening, everyone. Don't forget to check us out every week right here on TBS. Very funny.
Oh, God.
So, yeah.
$1.25. Well, I'm very excited about today's story. We are talking about a 16th century Sufi Muslim poet and weaver who is regarded as a saint. His name is Shah Hussein, and he fell in love with a much younger Hindu boy named Madho Lal. They're better known now as just one name, Madho Lal Hussein. Their shrine is both their graves side by side, and Hussein's death anniversary, or Urs, is celebrated in a 3-day festival that involves singing, dancing, wine, and smoking hashish. And there's nothing really ridiculous about their relationship, but it's really fascinating for a lot of reasons. And, I mean, Pakistan is distinctly unfriendly to gay relationships, which we'll get into later, but it's almost more unbelievable that these two were Muslim and Hindu than that they were two men. So there's a lot of layers to this, so let's get into it.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all, an abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
So I don't know if we just want to start right off the bat and just announce that, you know, I am not, and I don't know about you, but unless you've not told me something, neither of us is Muslim or Hindu or in any way, shape, or form from anywhere near the Middle East, nor were any of our ancestors. So
I did go to Egypt once. That's the closest I've been,
right?
I could say.
Quite a trip. So you've been to Egypt.
I have been to Egypt. That's it.
And this doesn't give us any more authority, but we are super interested in this story.
Mm-hmm.
We, of course, want to make sure that we diversify our stories here on this show a little bit.
Yeah, so true.
So we're really excited to tell this story. That being said, we might flub our pronunciations. So we're coming at this as best we can and try to do as much research, diligent research from the region as possible.
Right. So apologies to any Middle Eastern listeners who might be screaming at us in the way we're pronouncing these names. I'm very sorry. But it's a great story. I love it. So Shah Hussein, he was born in 1538 in the city of Lahore, which is in what's now known as Pakistan. At the time, I think it was the Punjabi region of South India, but it wasn't Pakistan yet. His father was an Islamic convert and enrolled him in this local school where he started to memorize the Quran. That's how they did it. It was just kind of by rote. You memorized the Quran until you knew it by heart. And there's a story that when he was 10, his mentor asked him to get some fresh water. And by the river, he was blessed by Al-Qadir, or the Green One. And after that, he was able to recite the entire Quran, even though he had only memorized a portion of it.
So this is like, this is like somebody walks up to me and is like, give me the Ten Commandments. And I'm like, sure, bing, bang, boom, and I list them all off. I don't think I've ever read them end to end.
I think there's some weird ones in there that nobody ever remembers. But
10's a pretty shabby number to pick for rules that govern all of humanity, right?
I feel like could be more.
But we're getting into the wrong religion.
True.
At any rate, you learn a little bit of it, and then all of a sudden you know the whole thing.
Yeah.
From a blessing.
Yeah.
That's pretty
good.
It's
like if you're plugged into the Matrix.
Oh, man. I was just going to make that reference.
I knew you were.
I love that you did. Totally. I need to know how to ride this motorcycle. And Al-Qadir shows up, snaps his fingers, does a dance, and boom, you can recite the Quran. And you're like, this isn't what I asked for, but this is, I'll find a use. This will be useful in some way as well.
I was like, man, I wish I had had an Al-Qadir in school.
Yeah.
Just blessed me and I knew everything on the test.
Mm-hmm.
Be pretty dope. But I guess there was probably something pretty special about Shah Hussein to be blessed by the Green One.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily anyone that goes to the river gets a blessing. So when he's 36, Hussein read this passage in the Quran. Hearken, ye folks, this world is a play and a show, a display of pageantry, pride, and boasting between yourselves and competing with one another for greater wealth and number of children.
Ooh.
True. And that's biting, but true. Naveed Alam, a literature professor who translated Hussein's poems in his book Verses of a Lowly Fakir, says, the words resonated so deeply with Hussein that he broke into a spontaneous dance of self-liberation. From this point onwards, he would not play the game for the sake of any success in the world, material or spiritual, but would rather become the amused player who treats the world as what it is, an ephemeral playground.
Hearken ye folks, this world is a play and a show. Very All the World's a Stage.
Yeah,
right?
Totally. I thought the same thing.
I don't know if Shakespeare ever read the Quran. But anyway, not quite the same point he was making. I just love that. Like, you know, he's just reading through the Quran. Oh, this is interesting. This is interesting. Here's a good passage. I like that. Whoa. Holy shit. Oh, I got to dance.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I am liberated. Like, what a wonderful feeling.
Well, and how better to express liberation than dance around?
Right. I just love that image of him just like throwing it down. Well, I'm sure he didn't throw it down.
I
just like reading that passage, looking up at the sky and just being like, I got to dance. Being so excited. I mean, like, you know, if I won the lottery, I would dance,
oh,
you know, spontaneously.
Yeah. True.
That kind of level of excitement.
It's like
just
a
like,
spiritual lottery he won. He found that piece that really made it work for him.
Man.
So he won the spiritual lottery.
Is that a better payoff?
I guess it depends on your point of view. Are you an earthly man or
situation.
A heavenly man?
Yeah.
So, because of his spiritual epiphany, he became a Malamatiya adherent. Malamatiya followers basically believe in humiliating their egos so they can get closer to true spiritual transcendence. You're not supposed to try for greatness or even social acceptance. Like, even praying in front of people was like a way to make them think you looked real holy or something. So even that was like frowned on. There's a great story about a Malamati who entered a village and people were treating him like a saint, following him around. I mean, like, tell us stuff so that we can learn from you. And he started urinating into the street so people would turn away from him, which was probably pretty effective. I know that that would work very well on me.
This sort of idea, like, don't look at me. I'm not God.
Right.
Right. Don't worship me.
Mm-hmm.
Don't come to me and think that I have all the answers. If you put too much focus on me, then you're not putting your focus on God, I guess is kind of the mentality here, right?
Yeah. Although I did see a blog or something that was written that was kind of like saying that by humiliating your ego and like trying so hard to have people turn away from you was kind of being really really turned in on yourself and thinking still about yourself and your
right.
own behavior and how
right.
you appear in the world. So it technically isn't getting you any clothes. But what, you know, I mean, people are going to argue points forever and ever about religion. So we're not going to make a judgment on that.
You can, I feel like you can get pedantic about it from any angle. You can be,
Sure. So, but what's cool about that is that social censure for his love of for a young boy would not only not be a problem for Hussein, but it might be part of the attraction to having a gay relationship is that people wouldn't like it, you know, and they'd be like, oh, we can't follow you anymore. And he'd be like, great, now I'm a better Malamati because people are paying less attention to me.
That's part of the discourse about him. Like that comes up.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's questioning if they were really in love or anything like that, but it was certainly like pointed out that like that could be kind of part of it was like, oh, I could do this and people would definitely have an opinion about it and it might, you know, help me be more holy, I guess.
Do you know what I need is my, what? Did you hear that? No. Oh, it's my headphones then.
What?
She said, please charge me.
Your headphones?
My
headphones
just... She said that in my ears.
Oh.
Please charge me.
Jeez.
So here's what I need. I'm going to have to go get it. I need some water and I need a different set of headphones.
Oh, okay.
As I need to apparently, please charge me for these. We'll be right. It's time for a commercial break anyway. We're at 11 minutes. So we'll be right back after this.
And we are back. We got headphones. We got water. And we got Shah Hussein. He developed quite a reputation. Alam says, a rebel fakir dressed all in red, bearing a wine flask in one hand and an earthen bowl in another.
That was my senior picture.
Oh.
Actually, yeah, in high school. I had a wine flask in one hand and an earthen bowl in the other.
I hope the wine flask was full of water or something.
Yeah, no, I graduated high school at 27.
Oh,
so.
Wow. I thought you were so much smarter than that.
No,
I'm learning
turns out
too much about you.
I'm a big dummy. All right, so unlike Jesus, who turned water into wine, Hussein turned wine into a non-alcoholic beverage. So
that's
there's,
cool.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess. I mean, it's cool to be able to do it. I would certainly be impressed.
Mm-hmm.
But I might be like, that was like a $14 bottle of wine.
Yeah, there's another legend that the Emperor Akbar was not impressed by his wine to water miracle.
Yeah, any drunk can turn wine into water. I see them releasing themselves in the street every day. Take him away.
Emperor Akbar, who is played by Rip Torn in this movie. Terrible casting.
Look, I got a narrow range of voices. So they sent him to prison for that. But then his likeness appeared to a harem attended by royal ladies. And Akbar suddenly believed his credentials as a saint and they set him free.
Yeah, I guess because he was in his cell.
Right.
And the ladies are seeing him in a totally different place.
Yeah.
So he's like, well, I guess... You're not just turning wine into urine, you're like appearing.
Which either miraculous or phenomenal trick. The old like he's in prison, so he had to sneak out, go appear to this harem of young ladies and then sneak back into prison. Because breaking back into prison is the hard part.
True, very true.
Breaking
maybe
out,
like
I
a
see
mirror
it
trick.
In the movies all the time, but a mirror trick? He had like 16 mirrors lined up throughout the palace.
Well, I think he appeared. He's a saint and he appeared.
But in the year 1590, he was 54 years old. And this is the first time he saw 16-year-old Sheikh Madolal, who is only described as a Hindu boy of matchless beauty. And it was love at first sight, according to some.
Yeah, some resources are very clear that it was romantic love. But others say they were lifelong friends or had a spiritual love, but not a sexual one. I don't know. I think it was sexual, personally, because some of the poems that he wrote mention Mado by name. And there's one very romantic one that mentions a male lover. We're going to go on down to our ridiculous romance poetry corner, where we're going to hear from Shah Hussein. Don't forget to tip your bartender.
My lover grabbed my arm. Why would I ask him to let go? Dark night, drizzling, painful. The approaching hour of departure. You'll know what love's all about once it seeps into your bones. Why dig a well in brackish soil? Why sow a seed in sand? You, who are making giant leaps, one day you'll be leapt over, my man. Says Hussein, the humble fakir. Look into the lover's eyes and let the gaze remain interlocked.
That is beautiful, by the way. But they didn't sound anything like that, of course, because there was no Beatnik coffee shop at the time.
They weren't in English.
They weren't
of
in
course.
English. That was a Navid Alam translation. They were also set to music and usually sung. So I totally recommend going on YouTube and looking up a coffee and hearing it because it's very special. It's different. And apparently it could change the meaning of the poem, like how what they chose to emphasize and stuff like that. So anyway, they're really cool.
Yeah.
And that type of poem is called a coffee, I think. K-A-F-I, a coffee poem.
Currently, it is illegal to be gay in Pakistan, at least as of the recording of this episode. It's harder to say about 1538 Punjab. The Kama Sutra has explicit instructions for homosexual acts, so we know they were thinking about it.
True.
Somebody was doing it. And we also found that Emperor Barber, emperor of the Mughal dynasty, had references to his erotic love for a teenage boy in his memoirs. That was 1529. And like many South Asian nations, in Pakistan, there's a commonly accepted notion of a third gender that is neither man nor woman. So being transgender is fairly well tolerated there. And even in 2018, they added some broad civil rights protections for transgender people in their laws. So that's good. But is currently, if I understand correctly, is currently illegal to be gay.
Yeah, that's apparently the Brits' fault. When they came in to colonize, they brought their own laws with them, and part of that was making homosexuality illegal. Now their law is a mixture of Anglo-Saxon and Islamic law, and apparently gay Pakistanis can be subject to secular punishment like prison, religious punishment like whipping or stoning, or both.
So you're telling me that the English came into a region that had nothing to do with, started changing things, and made it worse?
I know, it's hard to believe.
This is outrageous.
Hard to believe.
Point to me one other time in history where that happened, and my jaw will be on the floor.
Yeah, it's not even really talked about in their politics at all. A lot of people object to gay marriage or gay relationships, period, on religious grounds, which is a very familiar argument. Sociologists Stephen O. Murray and Badruddin Khan wrote in their book Sex Longing and Not Belonging that the penal laws are rarely enforced, but often used by police and private citizens as a form of blackmail. If Mahdo and Hussein were alive and together today, it's likely they'd be socially censured for their love. But as we talked about, he was Malamati, so that wouldn't really have bothered them. And his intentional poverty made him hard to blackmail. So I'm not sure how much, if any, you know, day-to-day persecution they faced at the time. It's kind of hard to find stuff about that.
Shah Hussein loved Mahdo so much that he changed his name officially to Mahdolal Hussein. That was their combined names, so they'd be unified forever. So that was a reference to both of them. They were a single unit with one name, a combination of those two names.
Yeah, and it had the unintended side effect of making it hard for a podcast host to find anything about Mahdo's life, since all the research is about Hussein. But I guess that didn't occur to him in 1590 for some reason.
Yeah, they weren't worried about their SEO.
Yeah, they weren't like, how are people going to search for this?
Well, if we combine our names, nobody will be able to find our Facebook profiles. I suppose they would have had a joint profile, like some couples do.
Oh, cute.
I mean, it's
not really.
I'm not into it now.
No. There was a cool thing written about how they put their names together because he was a weaver. So they were talking about how he's like combining, like weaving their lives together and their names
Brilliant.
Together and everything about them together. So they might actually like very much that you can't find much about them separately because that was the idea.
So this was kind of the benefer. Of their day, the Brangelina.
The Brangelina of their day.
These guys were not the Brangelina of their day in so many ways.
So many. So different. But I guess, they were a little bit of a celebrity.
They wanted to be thought of as a unit.
In 1593, Mahdo embraced Islam and converted. Hussein was his spiritual mentor. They had something like 10,000 followers. That didn't seem to mean much because of the whole Malamati thing. When someone wanted to be initiated by Hussein, he would just say, "Shave your head and drink an earthen bowl of wine with me," which has invited Dionysian comparisons.
I want to bring up an elephant that I feel like is in the room.
Okay.
Okay. Shah Hussein was 54 years old when they met. Motilal was 16. Is that right? Okay. And then the kid converted to his religion. So there is an angle through a modern lens, certainly a modern Western lens that we have right here between us, that this might be considered a sort of grooming, that there's like something kind of uncomfortable about this as well. I mean, I know we're talking about it as a beautiful story, but I think there is a kind of an element that's like, I'm not sure.
Right. And I think when they met too, Shah Hussein was already kind of being seen as a saint and this spiritual man. And right. I mean, since he was 10, you know, people are like, he's been blessed and he's this, you know.
He came into this relationship with a lot of power.
Yeah. Which is why I was trying to find stuff about Mahto before he ever got with Shah Hussein, because I was kind of like, maybe, you know, how did he meet him? Was he trying to convert? Because there were people, you know, interested in converting at that time, like Shah Hussein's own father and everything. So I don't know.
And we don't know what a 16-year-old boy in the region in the time, you know, may have had a full-time job and been, you know, a very independent adult for thinking person.
Right.
But did want to address that.
Sure.
Because it is kind of we're approaching this as a very like kind of beautiful romance, but you could look at it and be like, it's kind of not okay.
Yeah, I think in the 21st century, it would be a lot harder to be like, oh, that's nice to see. But yeah, you want to think in that time period all over the world, people were kind of coming of age much, much younger than they are now. So it's kind of just a totally different thing, not only culturally in that culture, but in general in the world. I think age stuff was very different. I don't know. Right. It's a weird one.
Yeah.
And from a 21st century lens, it's a weird one.
Right. And of course, we're just approaching this like telling the story. We certainly don't have the education or the experience to speak on things like that. But worth bringing up. I'm sure people would be listening to this thinking, the fuck, this is not okay.
But yeah, at least what I've read, it seemed to be very pure. But of course, again, we're looking at it from just a totally different
perspective. And who wrote that? You know, yeah, right.
Oh, right. Well, you know, a good point.
But actually, we will get more into Mahto's own life when we come back from our commercial break. So we'll get into that right after this.
Yeah. We are back from our break and we're talking about Shah Hussein and Mahto Lal. Now, Hussein died at the age of 63 in 1599, so they really only got 9 years together. And Mahto became the leader of Hussein's, 10,000-some followers, until he died at 73 in 1647 and was buried next to him. And it says that he secluded himself in Hussein's temple for the rest of his life, which means he spent 48 years alone. That's devotion.
Right.
Would you, if I dropped dead just now, would you seclude yourself for the next 48 years?
I would seclude myself for 48 minutes. And then I would want to be near friends for 48 hours. and then I would have to look at the list and see who's next.
There's a list?
Yeah. Tilda Swinton.
Oh, right. That list.
Natalie Portman. Chris Hemsworth. Letitia Wright, and then we just cut through the MCU. Like there's a ranking there
until you find one that says yes.
Until I find somebody that says
the
first
yes. Person who says yes.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you.
Yeah. What about me? If I peaced out?
Oh, would I seclude myself for 48 years? I doubt it.
I know you you could barely seclude yourself this year from the raging pandemic. No, but you were itching.
I don't know how many dates I'd go on. I don't know that I would be trying real hard for another romantic relationship.
It's the same list. Natalie Portman, Letitia Wright.
I mean, Kate Blanchett's on my list.
Kate Blanchett is, of course, on my list. She's tied with Tilda Swinton.
Chris Hemsworth, certainly. Chris Pine. Chris Evans.
Oh, you got the Chris's, right?
Yeah, I got all my Chris's.
Chris Pratt isn't on there.
No. That's okay.
Yeah. Well, he's running his mouth too much.
True. Yeah.
So, but at any rate, that kind of goes back to what we were talking about. I mean, this guy spent the next 48 years of his adult life continuing this man's, you know, worship.
Kind of his legacy, yeah, I guess.
It does seem like, you know, this was something that was really passionate to him. It wasn't, I mean, you could argue about whether or not that grooming just lasts throughout life or that kind of thing, but I think...
Yeah, he was pretty much like, I'm in, you know, and he stayed in even after Shah was gone. And the kafis that Shah Hussein wrote are still sung today and have appeared in some Bollywood films.
That's cool.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And their love story continues to resonate because the two defied social norms and exemplified the concept of universal love.
And again, we mentioned this earlier, but the fact that they were a Muslim and a Hindu was almost more shocking than the fact that they were two men.
This situation is very complex. Could be a multi-episode podcast on its own.
Right.
But here's a very short, inexpert summary of the situation between India and Pakistan.
Oh, yikes. Go ahead.
Welcome
give it
to the world affairs class.
Diana Banks. Let's hear it.
Okay, so India and Pakistan were once one country. Mm-hmm. They had some conflict within because they were the two major religions jockeying each other. And besides that, they have Sikhs and Buddhists and Jains and so on. So it's a pretty tough conflict to settle. You can't just be like, we're a Hindu nation, that's it. There's too many factions or whatever to be doing that. And then in 1947, the British split the country into majority Hindu India and Muslim Pakistan. And the resulting 70 years of conflict is often blamed on the Brits. But I saw a diplomat article that argued that it was inevitable for the region to be in conflict due to the thousands-year history of relations between Hindus and Muslims in South Asia. And they kind of were like the idea of a two-nation state was already being kicked around before the Brits ever got there, and that it's almost... condescending to say that as soon as they stepped in, it kind of ruined everything.
Like that's even that is kind of giving credit to, the Brits that they don't deserve.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure they didn't help anything.
They rarely did.
Very rarely. But they got some spices out of it, I guess.
Yeah, they helped themselves to better food.
They helped themselves and then didn't use it. Anyway, we won't get into that. But anyway, did not seem to help much that they split it into a two-nation state because there's this highly populous region called Kashmir that was supposed to go to Pakistan in the original British deal. But at the time, they had a Hindu Maharaja who said, India, if you protect me, you can have Kashmir. You need to protect me from these Pakistan Muslim invaders. So three wars were fought over Kashmir. Until in 1972, a UN-monitored ceasefire created the line of control, partly controlled by India, partly by Pakistan, and then there's a less populated part of this high-altitude area that's controlled by China. And since then, it didn't work. It didn't really work. Since then, they have faced off over the LOC because India says the whole place is theirs and that the Pakistani claims are not legitimate because they're terrorists and they're using terrorist violence to kind of stake their claim. And Pakistan argues that the majority of people who live in India-controlled Kashmir are Muslim, and if they were given a choice, they would be part of Pakistan. And their dispute is a big deal to the whole world because they both tested nukes in 1998. So it was real uneasy over there, to say the least.
Fun.
And the diplomat article I mentioned before quotes the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, as saying, Hindus and Muslims neither intermarry nor eat together, really stressing the differences between their worldviews, religion, society, and everything would make it impossible for them to coexist in a single state.
But long before Jinnah was founding Pakistan based on that idea, and long before the nukes were going off and anybody even thought about it, a Hindu and a Muslim did eat together and basically married each other and formed one person under one name. So still today, they extend as an example of love and harmony being found between Muslims and Hindus.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the 3-day Festival of Lights that we mentioned at the top of the episode used to be 2 separate celebrations. According to an article on Dawn, the Urs death anniversary and Mela festival were 2 separate events, one carried out at the shrine and the other was at the adjacent Shalimar Gardens until they were combined into one, Mela Chirigan, Festival of Lamps, by the 18th century ruler Ranjit Singh. The spring Mela, revered by the Hindus, and Urs, celebrated by the Muslims, signified union and harmony among the two faiths when combined into one celebration, remembering the bond of Shah Hussein and Madho Lal. I think that's beautiful.
That's quite lovely. When two become one, just like the Spice Girls sang.
Wow.
You know, speaking of the Brits coming in and ruining everything, oh, we're going to bring the Spice Girls in to ruin the end of the episode.
Spice World, okay. The Spice World.
But where
did
they get that spice?
Great question.
India. Thanks a lot.
They didn't have no ginger spice before they went into India, I guess.
I mean, I guess they had ginger, but they didn't have... But I think they had what? Salt?
Pepper?
And maybe they had black pepper. And they barely used it.
Mm-hmm. They salted
meat. To this day.
To like preserve it because there was no refrigeration.
I don't know. We went pretty hard after the Brits this episode. But yeah, they can handle
they're
it.
They're fine.
They're doing okay. I mean, they're not doing as good as they were. Well. But that's probably for the best.
But anyway, I just think this is such a cool story. It's such a romance that just... sings through the ages, you know, it's still so important to that region for that reason, just about peace and harmony and love and finding something to love about one another, even if you don't agree on everything. I'm sure that there's people who are like, well, he did convert. So it's not like a Hindu and a Muslim were together the whole time. It was kind of 2 Muslims were together. But still, I think obviously that still matters a lot. Yeah, it's just a beautiful story.
And like all great stories, there are definitely some things you kind of turn a blind eye to, like the age gap, which again is super uncomfortable. And I guess that's really the main one. Mm-hmm. But I guess urinating in the streets, that's not been a part of our beautiful stories that we've told to this point.
Yeah.
But maybe it'll come up more.
Maybe
tune
more
in next week
will.
And maybe you'll hear a beautiful story about Tilda Swinton and her life partner doing an art piece, the urinate in the streets. At any rate, it's a cool story. And you know what? It's one of the stories we've told so far that doesn't end horribly.
That's true.
Just a romance.
Just a romance.
A romance. Yeah. Ridiculous in its own right. But it's like ridiculous in a positive way, like breaking the norms, challenging social structures, religions coming together. That's kind of ridiculous.
Right. Well, and depending on your opinion about war, that's pretty ridiculous that people are fighting over an imaginary border that was never there in the first place. And now it is there arbitrarily drawn and they're having a whole bunch of death and murder over it. But, you know, that's another story.
No, real quick, before we go, I want to solve the India-Pakistan crisis.
Oh, okay.
So
go for it. I'd love to hear Ambassador Eli's.
Eli listen, let me tell you something. You go over here and you go over there and everybody put your hands in your pockets and we're going to have a good time. Has anybody ever said that? Has anybody ever gone over there and said that? I guess that's what the white people did.
Oops. And it didn't work out.
It didn't.
So maybe we should keep our big fat noses out of this one.
All right. Well,
just don't put off any nukes. Like, that's when it becomes a problem for everybody. So other than that, it's kind of like...
No one's saying it's not complicated.
But it's not for me to figure out.
It's not. Certainly not for us to decide.
No.
But let's keep the atoms unsplit. So, long story short, figure it out, guys. Let's
get it together.
All across the globe. You know what? Nations across the world. Right. Let's stop. Okay? Just stop the fighting. Let's just figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, is it so hard?
Yeah.
Yes,
it is.
It is hard. Damn it, I really thought we were going to solve it that time.
Not today. Sorry, guys.
We better
Maybe
leave
next
before
time.
We cause an international incident.
Ooh.
So you can reach out to us, please be kind, at romance at iheartmedia.com.
Yep, or slide into the DMs. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DynamiteBoom.
And I'm at, oh great, it's Eli.
And don't forget to follow and like and share and give us some 5-star reviews and all that good stuff.
Special thanks this week to everyone who helped us get this show off the ground. Ben Bolin and Noel Brown and the whole ridiculous team at iHeartRadio.
Also John Rigney, Brian and Mario Gomez-Bauer, and Cherry Del Rosario and Jason Mallory.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
So long, friends, it's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.